welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I don't have much left of my voice. I shredded my voice just earlier today. And so I have to apologize if I sound a little weak or faint-voiced. How do I sound to you, Paul? Paul's with us, folks.
Well, you know, if I have the opportunity, I'll try to give you a break from that because you really do sound like you're strained. Yeah, so yeah. I'll do as much reading as we need and sharing, okay?
Yeah, so let's do this because, folks, we're kicking off with the last state, the North Carolina debates. And typically what I like to do is I like to give kind of a little background looking at how they formed. And there's some details regarding the North Carolina debates that we'll get into. But let's just go ahead and get started because that'll give me a break and Paul can start really reading. And we're going to find in North Carolina, much like Virginia, because there were a lot of people that were very profoundly educated and understanding the constitutions and so forth. And North Carolina was a very similar configuration of a state like Virginia, where it was established based on economic freedom versus religious freedom, where Massachusetts and some other states like Pennsylvania and so forth were really more developed and established with a religious, you know, migration and so forth. But the Carolinas, Georgia was a strategic one, but anyway, I can just keep on talking and completely lose my voice, but let's not do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with Mr. Caldwell, and he makes the point that I always make. Whenever people read the We the People in the Constitution, it creates a context that it's a democracy. In other words, that has the smacks of a democracy instead of, you know, the representatives of the people that we have selected or something like that. So anyway, I'll let you go ahead and start. And then, as you notice, Paul, we're going to kind of go from Mr. Caldwell's makes a comment to Mr. McLean. So as you can tell, Mr. Caldwell is somebody that wants to understand. He's an anti-federalist. Mr. McLean, Mr. Davey, and Mr. Mr. McLean and Mr. Iredell are probably the two strongest federalists that we're going to really cover in here. And Mr. Davey actually brings up some interesting points. But anyway, so let's go ahead and dive in. Go ahead.
I'm ready. Here we go. So this is, at this point, this is Mr. Caldwell.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if they mean we the people at large, I conceive the expression is improper. Were not they who framed the Constitution the representatives of the legislatures of the different states? In my opinion, they had no power from the people at large to use their name or to act for them. They were not delegated for that purpose. So, GR, just real quick, this is they're referring to the preamble.
That is
correct.
And
I guess, Mr. Caldwell is objecting that it's starting with we the people. So I guess Mr. McLean, who I'm going to read now, is going to respond to that. Is that right?
That is correct. Okay. And so you got to remember that I'm not sure if McLean was there, but it should have been brought up every time that was brought up. They should have actually stated that they changed the preamble or the very beginning of the Constitution from we the people of the states of, and then listed the states. In other words, they actually said, they actually stated, we the people of the state of Georgia, we the people of the state of South Carolina, we the people of North Carolina, we the people of, and they literally had this long listing and the repeating because they didn't know if every state was going to ratify the Constitution so that they could actually, were they going to, take that out or not? So what they ended up doing was they just basically said, it went to the Stiles Committee, and the Stiles Committee goes, what happens if Rhode Island doesn't ratify? then we've got this title right. including them. And so they said, well, let's just go with we the people.
They just not just we the people. Then they add we the people of the United States.
Yes.
And they weren't emphasizing. They were with emphasis on states. So I think the sentence represents the people and the states. But let's see what Mr. McLean says.
Okay. Yep.
The Reverend gentleman has told us that the expression we the people is wrong because the gentlemen who framed it were not the representatives of the people. I readily grant that they were delegated by states, but they did not think that they were the people, but intended for it. But intended it for the people at a future day. The sanction of the state legislatures was in some degree necessary. It was to be submitted by the legislatures to the people so that when it was adopted, it is the act of the people. When it is the act of the people, their name is certainly proper. This is very obvious and plain to any capacity. Okay?
Okay.
That was it.
Sure. Go on.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now apparently Mr. Davey is going to say something about exceeded commission or how, I guess, there was, wow, he had a lot to say
so
about how.
Yeah, so he did. But you'll notice that he's responding to the Reverend gentleman as well.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
So this is so long. Stop me at any time or I'm going to stop if I have any
questions.
Yeah,
sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is Mr. Davey. Mr. Chairman, the observation of the Reverend gentleman is grounded, I suppose, on a supposition that the federal government exceeded their powers.
The federal convention.
Objection,
the federal convention.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The federal convention exceeded their powers. Thank you for that correction. This objection has been industriously circulated. But I believe on a candid examination, the prejudice on which this error is founded will be done away. As I had the honor, sir, to be a member of the convention, it may be expected I would answer an objection personal in its nature and which contains rather a reflection on our conduct than an object to the merits of the Constitution. After repeated and decisive proofs of the total inefficiency of our general government, the states deputed, is that deputed or deputed? Deputed, the members of the convention to revise and strengthen it. And permit me to call to your consideration that whatever form of Confederate government they might devise or whatever powers they might propose to give this new government, no part of it was binding until the whole Constitution had received the solemn assent of the people. What was the object of our mission? To decide upon the most effectual means of removing the defects of our federal union. This is a general discretional authority to propose any alteration they thought proper or necessary. Were not the state legislatures afterward to review our proceedings? Is it not immediately through their recommendation that the plan of the convention is submitted to the people? And this plan must still remain a dead letter or receive its operation from the fiat of this convention. Although the federal convention might recommend the concession of the most extensive powers, they could not put one of them into execution. What have the convention done that can merit this species of censure? They have only recommended a plan of government containing some additional powers to those enjoyed under the present feeble system. Amendments not only necessary, but which were the express object of the deputation. G.R., I think what he's saying here is, let me make sure I got this right, is he's answering the objection even today that this is a runaway convention.
That is correct.
That these people, that these people knew from the outset said that the defects in the Confederation were so blatant that they had to do whatever they had needed to fix it.
They actually had to reach into the Declaration of Independence's premise that when, you know, the government does not meet the needs of the people, we must either alter it or abolish it. And
right.
So they were at that point because they, like he was saying here, that they had all, you know, they had, I mean, they'd only kicked the tires on this thing. The ink had just barely dried, right. And they go, there are so many defects that, you know, we actually really need to, you know, consider anything and everything possible to get us to be able to, you know, consolidate this union for a true perpetual union instead of this lip service, the Confederation for a Perpetual Union, because that's all it was. It was lipstick on a pig.
Okay.
And one of the things that I think is really important, and it's worth straining my voice over, the difference between the Articles of Confederation.
Right. I'm trying to give you a break.
I understand that. The differences between the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution was the body delegates in the Constitution prayed. The body delegates in the, you know, in the hurry of trying to, change the Articles of Association to the Confederation in 1783, while they were still dealing with, you know, the finalities of the war and so forth, and trying to work out a peace, they were just in a rush. They did not have the same, and as a matter of fact, they lacked the leadership. I mean, when you see who was actually at, you know, both of the conventions, I mean, Washington was at the the second one, not the first. Benjamin Franklin wasn't in town or in the country at that time. He was in France still. So, I mean, there was a lot of leadership and there was a lot of wisdom, you know, in those hall or in Independence Hall in framing this Constitution, where, you know, they were able to, I'll just say they were far more receptive to receiving the spirit and the guidance from the divine hand of providence in what they needed to do. And they did not have that in the Articles of Confederation.
No, they did not. And so I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but there were presidents before the Articles of Confederation, right? I mean, no, I'm sorry, before the Constitution. And however, they weren't, as you said, apparently they just finished the war. They put this thing together and they needed to have something to express the Union, right?
So actually, what they had was they had an executive of Continental Congress. Like John Hancock was the president of the Continental Congress. So they always elected a president, but they didn't have a national president. They only had a national legislative body. They really didn't even have a Supreme Court. So they really didn't. Right. They were very limited in what they could do. So what they did was they said, you know, hey, obviously, you know, the supreme ruler is usually a magistrate that makes laws and enforces the laws and so forth. And so that's why they basically said a true government needs these functions of an executive, a judiciary, and a legislative. And so this is why they actually framed and created the model of governing in America with the three separate branches of separations of power. This concept of separations of power, you know, started at the federal level and it extended down to the states, and it should have extended down to the counties, if we've probably talked before about this. But anyway,
we have.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, he continues. Let me see. When we investigate this system candidly and accurately and compare all its parts with one another, we shall find it absolutely necessary to confirm these powers in order to secure the tranquility of the state and the liberty of the people.
So what are you thinking? Are you okay?
Hang on a minute. Hang on a minute, GR.
Okay.
I fixed it. I just had something go off and I just fixed it. So I apologize for that.
All right.
Okay. Tranquility of states and liberty of the people. Perhaps it would be necessary to form a true judgment of this important question, to state some events and develop some of these defects which gave birth to the late convention and which have produced this revolution in our federal government. With the indulgence of the committee, I will attempt this detail with as much precision as I am capable of. The general objects of the Union are, first, to protect us against foreign invasion. Second, to defend us against internal commotions and insurrections. Third, to promote the commerce, agriculture, and manufacturers of America. These objects are requisite to make us safe and a safe and happy people, and they cannot be attained without a firm and efficient system of union. As to the first, we cannot obtain any effectual protection from the present Confederation. It is indeed universally acknowledged that its inadequacy in this case is one of the greatest defects. Examine its ability to repel invasion. In the late Glorious War, its weakness was unequivocally experienced. It is well known that Congress had a discretionary right to raise men and money, but they had no power to do either. In order to preclude the necessity of examining the whole progress of its imbecility, permit me to call to your recollection one single instance. When the last great stroke was made which humbled the pride of Britain and put us in possession of peace and independence, so low were the finances and credit of the United States that our army could not move from Philadelphia until a minister of His Most Christian Majesty was prevailed upon to draw bills to defray the expense of the expedition. I'm missing something here. I'm not sure that I'm reading this right.
No, you are. But the war's over. So they're talking about something that's very common knowledge of how it went down at that time. And so you may not understand what he's talking about, but this is just he's giving a very specific example of what ended up happening. He's talking about, you know, the recollection of one single instance. That's what he's talking about. Okay, So the Most Christian Majesty was prevailed upon to draw bills to defray the expense of the expedition. These were not obtained on the credit or interest of Congress, but by the personal influence of the Commander-in-Chief, in other words, George Washington.
So what you're saying is, who is His Most Christian Majesty that he's referring to?
I have no idea. They're using jargon of the time, so you'd have to actually do some research on that. So, you know, I don't think it's that important. He's just trying to make an example here.
Okay. Okay, but apparently we didn't even have the war's over, and we didn't even have the money to move the army from one place to another until someone paid for it.
That's right.
It says a personal influence.
Obtained on credit or interest of Congress, but by the personal influence of George Washington. So in other words, George Washington said, hey, are we going to really lose this war that we just won? Because, you know, you're not going to give us credit anyway. So again, this is a historic point that he's just referring, that everybody is, you know, it was an embarrassment. There were all sorts of things that were an embarrassment of the Articles of Confederation. So go ahead.
Okay. Had this great project miscarried, what fatal events might have ensued? Is a very moderate presumption that what has once happened may happen again. The next important consideration, which is involved in the external powers of the Union, are treaties. Without a power in the federal government to compel the performance of our engagements with foreign nations, we shall be perpetually involved in destructive wars. The Confederation is extremely defective in this point also. I shall only mention the British treaty as a satisfactory proof of this melancholy fact. It is well known that although this treaty was ratified in 1784, it required the sanction of a law of North Carolina in 1787. And that our enemies, presuming on the weakness of our federal government, have refused to deliver up several important posts within the territories of the United States and still hold them to our shame and disgrace. It is unnecessary to reason on facts, the perilous consequences of which must, in a moment, strike every mind capable of reflection.
Okay.
Real quick.
Okay, yeah, and I wanted to interject anyway. He's pointing out, you know, the necessity. I mean, everybody is ignoring how inept and impotent this Continental Congress and this Confederation was. the general government mm-hmm. was completely incapable. And so when people, you know, at the time, you know, started making little squalors about, oh, or you make these, you know, assertions. Oh, they exceeded their commission, because everything he's giving us is really referring to the importance of what these men did in this convention and how they were mm-hmm. really, truly answering the call of the commission. It was to actually address the exigencies, because Madison even went through this. And so he's just making the points, you know, with all of these problems to say, are you kidding me? That, you know, they exceeded their commission? How? I mean, mm-hmm. we're at the point of failing, and, you know, it's almost like we've hit the ground and we're in the process of the dead cat bounce. If you understand that term. And, you know, it's almost like these guys that are running around saying, we got to stop this. These guys exceeded their commission. You know, really? Mm-hmm. This only speaks to the maniacal side of these cabals, how this little power, when we really look at the little power in context today, you know, these guys made this big deal about, look at all the power that these guys are going to have. Well, we look at, and we realize that they have no power to operate a Department of Transportation and Health and Human Services and Labor. I mean, none of these powers are delegated. If we really look at what the federal government should and only can be doing, I mean, it would be, you know, reduced, you know, by 90%.
Right.
And I'm going, well, you know, they sure did a great job in really containing, you know, the limitations of a federal government to allow it to do what it's supposed to do in protecting us, you know, and helping us, you know, maintain our sovereignty and protecting our sovereignty. But we don't even get that now. I mean, we literally have a monolithic government that is basically waging warfare against us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, you were going to make a point on top of that? We have about 2 minutes.
No, yeah. Well, so it was, I was wondering what they were referring to as the sanction of a law in North Carolina in 1787. But that's the question I had. But if we just got a couple of minutes.
So even though they may have had the treaties, you know, the authority, but they didn't have the authority to enforce any treaties. And so it required the sanction of law to enforce some form of the treaty in 1784. And so even Congress could go out and make these treaties. It was laughed at because Continental Congress did not have the authority to enforce it. They actually had to get the states to do that.
Oh, so they had to get North Carolina to pass a law in 1787 that would enforce. That's amazing.
Right. And this was brought up in some of the previous debates that we already read, where they talked about how the trade agreements, even though Continental Congress is supposed to actually have the sole ability of creating treaties for trade, every state in the union was creating their own treaties to, you know, to get what they really needed, because Continental Congress was inept. They really couldn't effectively get the treaties because they just didn't have the energy or the political energy and the power to do it and to enforce them. So anyway, so we got 20 seconds left. So, you know, this is one of the best arguments about, you know, exceeding the commission, or the fact that they didn't exceed their commission. They were truly answering the exigencies of the time, because had the United States failed here in 1788, this is when they're debating this, the French Revolution, things happened so slowly that the French Revolution was coming right around the corner. We got to cut to break, Paul, but we'll be right back after this. The French Revolution was just right around the corner. And had Napoleon come into office, you know, in 1792 or whatever, and he saw that America owed us money or owed them money, he would have sent his ships to America and we'd be speaking French today. And, you know, that would have been just tragic for the whole world. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so without any further ado, unless you've got, you know, some other point you want to bring up, by all means.
Yeah, so I was, let's go ahead. I had a question, and I don't remember what it was, and I thought it was a good one, but okay. The next head, I'm reading now, under which the general government may be considered is the regulation of commerce. The United States should be empowered to compel foreign nations into commercial regulations that were either founded on the principles of justice or reciprocal advantages. Has the present confederation affected any of these things? Is not our commerce equally unprotected abroad by arms and negotiation? Nations have refused to enter into treaties with us. What was the language of the British court on a proposition of this kind? Such as would insult the pride of any man of feeling and independence. Quote, you can make engagements, but you cannot compel your citizens to comply with them. You derive greater profits from the present situation of your commerce than we could expect under a treaty, and we have no kind of power that can compel us to surrender any advantage to you. End quote. This was the language of our enemies, and while our government remains as feeble as it has been, no nation will form any connection with us that will involve the relinquishment of the least advantage. What has been the consequence? A general decay of trade, the rise of imported merchandise, the fall of produce, and an uncommon decrease of the value of lands. Foreigners have been reaping the benefits and emoluments which our citizens ought to enjoy. An unjustifiable perversion of justice has pervaded almost all the states, and everything presented to our view has a view a spectacle of public poverty and private wretchedness.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, yeah, tell me how you really feel about it. This is, he is.
So there's,
you can see his words.
Yeah.
You can see the not just the irritation, but from his examples and his expression, he is really making the point of how just, difficult it was to live under the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
And now, still is at the time of their argument.
Okay, so one of the things he's pointing out here is the importance of regulating commerce among foreign nations, or actually, to be clear, let me actually pull this up because I want to actually have the, you know, the Constitution. So I'll pull up my color-coded Constitution and give you to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the states. Not within the states, or to regulate the states, it is, and among the states. So in other words, the importance was making sure that the states were protected from any type of aggression or hostility, you know, economic hostilities that other nations wanted to basically wage. And so when we created a treaty to basically come to, you know, let's say, to provide salts or fish or what have you, there had to be some form of power, or I should say energy, for in a foreign treaty to be able to turn to the states and say, look, you know, we've made this treaty. Now, it's not within the states, it's among the states. And as they create this treaty, whether it be salt or what have you, oil, what have you, they do have the power to create these trade agreements. They do not have the power to regulate commerce among the states or within the state specifically. Their job is to make sure that the states don't wage warfare against each other. But that's it. Everything otherwise, he's talking about, let me finish this.
No.
Everything that he's pointing out is the importance of the regulating of commerce between the nations and the states. That's it. That was the whole point of this whole power of commerce, of this commerce clause. So anyway, go ahead. If you wanted to add to that.
So otherwise, if I understand correctly, the states are completely free to have commerce between each other.
Yes.
It's just the idea that the go ahead.
So to be very specific, if Michigan wants to produce cars that, you know, do this, that, or the other thing, California has no ability to keep those cars out of their state. There is free trade among the states. In other words, you can't say we won't sell your product, just like they can't say we can't sell your product. And they started violating the Commerce Clause, and the federal government started playing these games of saying, yeah, for the environment, we're going to do this. Remember what Washington said in his farewell address. It's always with good intent that they start bypassing the Constitution without actually following the mode of amendments. So they assume the powers with usurpation, and this is the typical tools or the customary weaponry that they use to destroy nations. Because when they start stepping outside of that process, right. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So in terms of commerce, one state cannot tell another state, I'm not going to buy your goods because you're not making them the way I want you to.
Right. That's right. Correct.
Oh, wow. In other words, it's an enforcement of free commerce among the states.
Yes.
Okay. That's, wow. Okay. And the Constitution requires that. And
yes.
That is what the federal government is supposed to police. That's what they're supposed to enforce.
That's
in
right.
In other words, you know, there was a case in which a guy was growing his own food. You remember this one? He's growing his own either corn or wheat. And he gets pulled into court because it could have been under the Interstate Commerce Clause because it could have been used in interstate commerce.
Right.
Are you familiar
so,
with that?
Yes, it's Wicker v. Filburn, and it was 1943. And what ended up happening was the reason he was growing wheat was he was growing wheat because the cost of wheat was just ridiculous. And he lived in an area where wheat, you know, would be cheap to grow. And he grew it to feed his cattle. So it was basically he was growing wheat to feed his cattle. And the argument from the federal regulator was that because you're growing wheat, you've removed yourself from the market space where we could actually charge you the taxes for that wheat. And so they basically said, because you were growing this many acres, this means that you should have produced this many bushels and you should pay the taxes on those, you know, those bushels you produced, that you removed yourself from the market. And
wow.
And absolutely. I mean, the 30s and 40s, the federal government was absolutely out of control. And most people didn't even realize what was going on.
I take it he lost this case.
Yeah, so Wicker v. Filburn, yeah, absolutely. They did lose the case, and it's never truly been overturned. It can't set precedence. This is an absolute violation of the Constitution. And the fact that the way the Supreme Court is legislating from the bench itself is an outright violation of the Constitution. This is why, you know, one of the petitions we absolutely need to have is the, you know, one of the first petitions we need to do on top of all the ones we're doing is a petition to basically identify that legislation is only vested in Congress, that any legislation, anything that comes from the executive or the judiciary, cannot be law and cannot be imposed upon the states, period. Wow. That is right. An absolute violation of the separations of power, and the legislative powers are vested only in Congress, period. So whenever a court makes a decision, whether it be over marriage, whether it be over life or anything, they cannot impose that. The only thing they can do is in the decision itself, whether this was, you know, accurate or not, they can only rule on the case. They cannot impose law. It is one thing for them to, you know, to make an opinion, but it's another thing for them to invoke that opinion upon the states as law. What the Supreme Court is required to do is, if they feel that there needs to be a law or an amendment to the Constitution, then they have to appeal to the legislature, Congress in this particular case, and say, we see this is a shortcoming. You need to take care of this. And if the Congress doesn't, then Congress doesn't. But this is how Congress... Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead. So in other words, this idea that we have that the Supreme Court struck down law, okay, like struck down prayer in school, that's not correct, okay? The Supreme Court has the authority to make an opinion and even...
So let's say in the particular case, somebody was torturing somebody to say prayer. And they make it in their opinion that, you know, this is wrong. You cannot torture or use, you know, violate these rights. But we also believe that you just can't, you can't have prayer, period. So they add on to what the ruling is to an opinion. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Because 9 times out of 10, sometimes the opinion wanders well beyond the ruling. Because this is where, right. The ruling itself, like Maryland v. McCullough, was a ruling where the state of Maryland could not, impose a tax upon the federal government for the property of the national bank that they had there. They wanted to have property tax on this national bank. And so they said, you can't do that. And then they basically talk about the supremacy clause. And this is where Marshall starts aggrandizing the federal government in his opinion. It meant nothing. As a matter of fact, the only because Madison was, I think, president at the time, or he just walked away from his presidency in 1817. I think that's when Maryland v. McCullough went down. And the only reason Madison never made a statement about it was because it meant nothing. These were just opinions. It only happened later on after he passed, where they actually started saying, well, hey, we want to build precedents and we want to create case law based on all these opinions and invoke law this way. And this is what I was going to say. This is how these two, it's almost like a Mutt and Jeff routine, where one branch of the government may want to do something, but they can't, so they get the other, to use the bench to do this, and then to try to create case law and precedence. It's all unconstitutional. The only way it can be done is through an amendment. But they don't want to do that.
So if I understand correctly, this is what makes up the annotated Constitution.
Correct. Case law, precedents, how they're going to, it's their living constitution. They're making it up as they go along. That is correct.
Well, okay. All right. All right. I think we probably have a little time for the rest of...
About 14 and a half minutes. Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, this is a true representation of our situation. Can our general government recur to the ordinary expedient of loans? During the late war, large sums were advanced to us by foreign states and individuals. Congress have not been enabled to pay even the interest of these debts with honor and punctuality. The requisitions made on the states have been everywhere unproductive, and some of them have not paid a stiver. These debts are a part of the price of our liberty and independence. Debts which ought to be regarded with gratitude and discharged with honor. Yet many of the individuals who lent us money in the hour of our distress are now reduced to indigence in consequence of our delinquency. So low and hopeless are the finances of the United States that the year before last, Congress were obliged to borrow money even to pay the interest of the principal which we had borrowed before. This wretched resource of turning interest into principle is the most humiliating and disgraceful measure that a nation could take, and approximates with rapidity to absolute ruin. Yet it is the inevitable and certain consequence of such a system as the existing Confederation. You know, honor was important to these people, and paying their debts was important. In that time frame, I think people look at it differently, but back then it was not taken lightly, and the honor of the nation apparently was at stake. So let me go on. There are several other instances of imbecility in that system. It cannot secure to us the enjoyment of our own territories or even the navigation of our own rivers. The want of power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization through the United States is also no small defect, as it must unavoidably be productive of disagreeable controversies with foreign nations. The general government ought in this, as in every other instance, to possess the means of preserving the peace and tranquility of the Union. A striking proof of the necessity of this power recently happened in Rhode Island. A man who had run off with a vessel and cargo, the property of some merchants in Holland, took sanctuary in that place. Application was made for him as a citizen of the United Netherlands by the minister, but as he had taken the oath of allegiance, the state refused to deliver him up and protected him in his villainy. Had it not been for the peculiar situation of the states at the time, fatal consequences might have resulted from such conduct, and the contemptible state of Rhode Island might have involved the whole Union in a war. Wow. That's interesting.
Right.
Okay. They start that.
So just to be clear, now they start going into encroachments, but this, everything he's been talking about is just proving the case that they didn't have a general government. They had a laughingstock in the world. Mm-hmm. These sovereign states fought a revolutionary war, and the union that they were creating, to be honest with you, if you look at the economic union, the EU, they've just been a laughingstock. They've been unable to actually surrender their sovereignty to creating a general government like what we did. They've been trying to compete with the United States, you know, in every which way they possibly can. And they have failed every time because the jealousies of the independent states refused to surrender the necessary power as what had to happen with the United States.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. Very much so. Okay. We're in encroachments. How much time do we have?
So we have 10 and a half minutes. We should be able to get through all of this.
Yeah. Okay. We can do this. Okay. The encroachments of some states on the rights of others. This is still
Mr. Davey.
Mr. Davey. Mm-hmm. Right. The encroachments of some states on the rights of others and of all on those of the Confederacy are incontestable proofs of the weakness and imperfection of that system. Maryland lately passed a law granting exclusive privileges to her own vessels, contrary to the Articles of the Confederation. Congress had neither power nor influence to alter it. All they could do was to send a contrary recommendation. It is provided by the 6th Article of the Confederation that no compact shall be made between two or more states without the consent of Congress. Yet this has been recently violated by Virginia and Maryland, and also by Pennsylvania and New Jersey. North Carolina and Massachusetts have had a considerable body of forces on foot, and those in this state raised for 2 years, notwithstanding the express provision in the Confederation that no force should be kept up by any state in time of peace. As to internal tranquility, without dwelling on the unhappy commotions in our own back counties, I will only add that if the rebellion in Massachusetts had been planned and executed with any kind of ability, that state must have been ruined, for Congress were not in a situation to render them any assistance. Do you know which rebellion he's talking about?
Yes, it was the Shay Rebellion.
It was Shay's Rebellion.
Yep, okay. Shay's Rebellion in Massachusetts, okay. Yes.
Okay. Another object of the Federal Union is to promote the agriculture and manufactures of the states. objects in which we are so nearly concerned. Commerce, sir, is the nurse of both. The merchant furnishes the planter with such articles as he cannot manufacture himself and finds him in a market for his produce. Agriculture cannot flourish if commerce languishes. They are mutually dependent on each other. Our commerce, as I have before observed, is unprotected abroad and without regulation at home, and in this and many of the states ruined by partial and iniquitous laws which, instead of having a tendency to protect property and encourage industry, led to the depreciation of the one and destroyed every incitement to the other. Laws which basically warranted and legalized the payment of just debts by paper, which represents nothing, or property of very trivial value.
Right. And so they're kind of talking about paper money here, and he starts to go down that. And so we'll probably do a go back when I actually get a chance to scrub, because in all honesty, folks, I have not done another run through scrubbing, looking for very specific things. So there's probably more stuff, but we can go ahead and go down to the next citation. And this is where they start talking about slaves.
Right. Well, you know, he does quite the smackdown on the Articles of Confederation.
Oh, Mr. Yeah. Davy? Mr. Davy? Yeah. And he does some explaining on some slaves. So here you go. This is Mr. Gowdy makes a comment, and then Mr. Davy responds.
Okay. So this is Mr. Gowdy. Mr. Chairman, this clause of taxation will give an advantage to some states over the others. It will be oppressive to the southern states. Taxes are equal to our representation. To augment our taxes and increase our burdens, our Negroes are to be represented. If a state has 50,000 Negroes, she is to send one representative for them. I wish not to be represented with Negroes, especially if it increases my burdens. What is he saying here? I can't tell if he's for or against. It sounds like he's objecting to the taxes on slaves.
Yes, so you got to remember that the importation of slaves comes with a taxation.
Right.
Right.
Correct.
Okay. Okay.
All right. So this is Mr. Davy. Mr. Chairman, I will endeavor to obviate what the gentleman last upset. I wonder to see gentlemen so precipitate and hasty on a subject of such awful importance. It ought to be considered that some of us are slow of apprehension, or not having those quick conceptions and luminous understandings of which other gentlemen may be possessed. The gentleman, quote, does not wish to be represented with Negroes, unquote. This, sir, is an unhappy species of population, but we cannot at present alter their situation. The eastern states had great jealousies on the subject. They insisted that their cows and horses were equally entitled to representation.
Okay, so hold on here.
Okay.
This was in the convention he's talking about, you know, when the South wanted, because the South, you know, clearly it was well established that the slaves were considered property. And they wanted representation. And so they basically were mocked by some northern states. Have you ever heard this come up in the history books? That when they were actually standing up and saying, hey, we want, you know, our slaves to have representation. You can't have both. They're either property or they're men. Because remember, the northern states wanted to abolish slavery. And so when they said, okay, well, you know, if we're going to concede that property can, you know, have representation, that we want our cows to have representation. That's what he's saying here.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're countering the argument of the South that they're trying to spread their butter on both sides. Well, that's property, but, you know, they deserve representation. Because they understand that by counting heads, then it gives them more representation, because that gives them more voice in government. So, okay. So I'm just pointing out that the history books really make, you know, this whole concept of what they were doing in this constitutional convention as these compromises came out, that, you know, they didn't cover the fact that, you know, there were lots of little things that they put into it so that slavery would finally be weeded out. But okay, go ahead.
Yeah. The one question I hear people in my head asking is, if they're treated like property, why would they count them at all? And I guess it was part of the compromise because the representation was going to be only advantageous to the slave owners.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Yes. And well, advantageous to the affluent. Because not the, just the slave owners, because there were many slave owners that couldn't even afford to have slaves anymore. Only those who had the had the large enterprises where the marginal cost actually gave them good profits. Everybody else that was trying to compete with these small plantations or small farms with some slaves, they just couldn't compete. Because they were being constantly, these bigger plantations could sell their product at a cheaper price and literally make it hard for them to stay alive. That's how these large plantations were just getting larger and larger.
Got it.
Right.
Okay. So I'm going to repeat a line because it leads into the next line.
Go ahead.
This serves an unhappy species of population, but we cannot at present alter their situation. The eastern states had great jealousies on the subject. They insisted that their cows and horses were equally entitled to representation, that the one was property as well as the other. It became our duty, on the other hand, to acquire as much weight as possible in the legislation of the Union, and as the northern states were more populous than whites, this only could be done by insisting that a certain proportion of our slaves should make a poor part of the computed population. It was attempted to form a rule of representation from a compound ratio of wealth and population, but on consideration, it was found impracticable to determine the comparative value of land and other property in so extensive a territory with any degree of accuracy. The population alone was adopted as the only practical rule or site criterion of representation. It was urged by the deputies of the eastern states that representation of two-fifths would be of little utility, and that their entire representation would be unequal and burdensome, that in a time of war, slaves rendered a country more vulnerable while its defense devolved upon its free inhabitants.
There you go. So hold on.
Go ahead.
We need to stop here because we just barely have a minute left. And so he's actually laying out, many of the arguments, because they realize that even though the South may be able to, produce, both, goods and so forth, if they had to go to war, they had internal problems because by keeping these slaves, freeing them would have been, the only way to go. Because then they wouldn't have to worry looking over their shoulder, are we going to get shot in the back?
Okay.
Right. So anyway, I really appreciate you coming on, and I really appreciate you doing as much reading as you have. This is all great stuff. As you can tell, we'll have to pick it up from where we left off here, and I'll remind you tomorrow. So anyway, folks, we're out of here. I hope you're starting to see the value of the conversations and the details that the ratification debates give us. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.